As they go, I'm going to tell you we're actually going to alter the plan again here. We have two more Hebrew sermons coming, and one of them was going to be today, but I got convicted to do something else here today. And so, I won't explain you all the reasons for this, but so Hebrews is actually going to be finished on September 16 and September 23rd. It's going to be off a few weeks. So technically, our little label of summertime schooling won't apply, I guess, anymore in the middle of September, but we'll finish it up then. So just wanted to explain that to you before we get going here. Okay, so don't know if you're familiar with the Christian band Skillet, but they sing a song that's called Sick of It. And the lyrics have been running through my mind this past week. It's raise your hands if you're sick, if you're sick of it. Raise your hands if you're sick, if you're sick of it. Now, I often will play songs for you at the beginning of a sermon if it fits with the topic I'm preaching on that day, but I'm not actually going to do that today. Typically, the reason I might do that is to provide a little entertainment up front or use it for illustrative purposes, but this message today is not a light subject that we are going to attach any entertainment to. I'm meaning those words today in the most serious possible manner. Raise your hands if you're sick, if you're sick of it. And change the mood here for us, okay? I'm sick of it. I am sick of all the evil and dark things that continue to occur in our country and in our world that dominate our news headlines. I don't know how encouraging it's ever been to look at the news headlines. I usually am anxious to skip to the sports section, but man, is it tough these days. Sick of the way politics is practiced in our country. I'm sick of reading about church leaders who have failed in their calling due to immoral behavior, especially the leaders from within our evangelical church that we're a part of. Stuff makes me sick to my stomach. Raise your hands if you're sick of it. Now, as your pastor, I don't want to get sucked into continually preaching on current events. I think our main purpose here on Sundays needs to be sticking in the Word of God. But every once in a while, I do think a pastor is responsible to use the sermon time to try to apply the principles of God's Word to things that are being discussed and going on in our communities, in our nation, in our world. I've done a bit of this recently here, and I probably normally would have tried to steer away from that kind of thing for a while, but got to tell you, the events of these past few weeks coming across the news headlines have been especially disheartening, and I'm just feeling compelled to speak on them today. And I'm going to tell you right now, we're going to go overtime today, all right? So if you have something you got to be at shortly after noon, you may want to move to the back row right now, because we're going to go over. I have some things I got to say today. So, well, if you took Highway 212 down through Granite Falls, and then you headed southwest through Mankato and eventually got to I-35 and Albert Lea, and then you went another 2 hours south on I-35, eventually jogging over a bit to the east, you would end up in Brooklyn, Iowa. Population of Brooklyn, Iowa, according to Google, was 1,468 in the 2010 census. And for comparison, the population of Madison, Minnesota, according to Google, was 1,551 in the 2010 census, a difference of 83 people. I looked it up this week. Brooklyn, Iowa has 5 churches, a big flag display, an old, non-functioning 1950s-era gas station that's been all fixed up. They have a racetrack called the Brooklyn Speedway. They have an FM radio station there, a grain elevator, a medical clinic, a True Value hardware store, and a Casey's gas station. Does it sound familiar? And until this past summer, the vast majority of Americans had no idea that Brooklyn, Iowa existed. And that all changed when a 20-year-old college student living in and raised in Brooklyn named Molly Tibbetts went for a jog on July 18th in the daylight, 7:30 p.m., A 24-year-old farm worker living in the area named Christian Rivera began following her in his car as she jogged, eventually getting out and running with her. And when she threatened to call the police on him, her cell phone, he assaulted and eventually killed her. So raise your hands if you're sick of it. Bill Hybels has been a highly effective pastor for many, many years. Way back in 1975, he founded Willow Creek Church, which is located just outside of Chicago. And it grew to the point where in this past year, over their three weekend services in multiple locations, they averaged 26,000 attendees. Bill Hybels and Willow Creek Church have been quite influential within the wider evangelical church in America. My wife has often watched videos of his sermons over the past few years and has really loved the style and substance of his messages. I showed a little video clip in one of my early sermons here as your pastor of Mr. Hybels, and it was, I remember it being quite impactful for many of you. Bill's encouragement in that video was for us to be sure to be having rocking chair moments with God in our lives, prioritizing a time of daily prayer and Bible study. Well, most of you will have heard by now that some accusations started surfacing over the past few years, women saying that Pastor Hybels had sexually harassed them. And these accusations ranged from his being somewhat inappropriate with them to the point that they were a bit uncomfortable, all the way up to accusations of sexual affairs. He has now retired early and continues to deny that the allegations against him are true. His church board stood with him until, it seems, that the increasing number of accusers, as well as the increasing substance of the stories they were relaying, finally tipped the balance, and the board started believing the women instead of the pastor that they loved. The whole board has since resigned, and the church has hired an outside group to conduct an investigation into the truth. And so in this, the evangelical church, the group that I believe is closest to the correct teaching on the Bible and on Jesus, we capture all the national news headlines for all the wrong reasons. A major embarrassment and stain, not just on our group, but on the teaching that we're presenting to the world. We've given the world in this newsworthy story a reason to ignore or disregard our message. Critical failing, and a terribly sad thing. You know, even if these accusations are true, and it certainly looks like they are, I don't believe that this means that Bill Hybels was a complete fraud. I would guess that he really believed and meant the things he preached, but that he also had sin going on in his life at the same time. And it has done now what sin does. It has brought destruction into the lives of those he was inappropriate with, and destruction upon his church and upon the church. And Bill now retires with this label of failure upon him. Instead of being able to retire as a respected pastor who had done so much good for the kingdom, what a tragedy this is. He was preaching the right things, like having your rocking chair moments with God. Those were the right things to preach. And you know, he preached the Word of God, and the Word of God went forward into people's lives. But now we look at what that secret sin of his wrecked. And I wish I could say that Mr. Hybels was the only example of an evangelical leader who's failed in these ways, but he's not. And yeah, so when I read these stories, they make me feel sick inside. Well, then there's politics. Get a lot of that in the news, of course, and yes, I'm largely sick of that too. You know, our American forefathers gave us the greatest political system in the world. But I would like to describe to you how I think we have generally practiced politics within that great system in America. I believe that our political process is often practiced in an angry and a cruel spirit. Lying is routinely used in order to accomplish personal or group goals. The truth is spun or disregarded by many. Inflammatory statements are used to get people all riled up. Money plays far too big a part in who makes it into the political system and in what bills get passed. Much of what goes on seems to be selfish, and of course there are plenty of moral failings in this group of leaders as well. Now, of course, these descriptions don't fit every political leader. We know that. But would you agree that these things seem to be accurate about the general way in, that politics is practiced in our country? And I hope you know I'm not talking about one person or one party here. This is not a problem for the Republican Party or a problem for the Democratic Party. This is a problem for the Republican and the Democratic Party. It's been like this for as long as I can remember. Maybe it's always been like this. I don't really know. But I can tell you that I have never seen it as bad as it is right now. And I don't know about you, but I'm sick of it. Lots to be sick about in the news headlines these days. What in the world can we do about it? Well, we've said it here before, and we'll say it again because it's the truth. When you're dealing with issues on this grand scale, you know, how to stop the leaders in the worldwide church from failing morally, how to fix American politics, how to stop violence and murder that's happening routinely in our country and all over the world. All you can do when you're dealing with problems on that type of scale is try to use your time here on the earth to affect the people that you come into contact with, to try to make change in your community and in your church. That's what you can do. You know, maybe we can put a dent in this wider picture by trying to find, if you can, find godly politicians to vote for. Or by sending money to, you know, supporting missionaries that are living in other communities around the world. But all we can do is what we can do, right? So what can we do to help battle against these things that are plaguing our world? I want to think about that together with you today. And let's go backwards through the topics I just brought up with you. So that means we'll start first with politics. What can we do about the way American politics is practiced? Starts with us, I believe. Before we seek to get other people to alter their behaviors, we better be sure that we are getting it right and that we're learning from the Lord how He would have us live. So I want to read again that list of complaints I just gave to you about the way politics is practiced in our country. Here it is. I said that I believe American politics are generally practiced in an angry and cruel spirit. Lying is routinely used in order to accomplish personal or group goals. The truth is spun or disregarded by many. Inflammatory statements are used to get people riled up. Money plays far too large a part in who makes it into the political system and what laws get passed. Much of what goes on seems to be selfish, and of course there are plenty of moral failings among this group of leaders. That's what I said. Let's look now at some Bible verses. Here's James 1, 19 and 20. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Whew, that's a good one. Okay, starts with us. So when we're in debates in our lives about politics or just about anything, way things should go, are we quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry? Starts with us. John 4:20. If anyone says, I love God, but hates his brother, he's a liar, for he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Colossians 3:12, therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. We're to be gentle and patient people, not angry people. We're to be loving and kind people, not cruel people. Leviticus 19:11, do not lie, do not deceive one another. Psalm 15, Lord, who may dwell in your sacred tent and who may live on your holy mountain? The one who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from their heart, whose tongue utters no slander. So are we living as people committed to truth who do not twist it for our advantage? Starts with us. Do we like to say things that inflame and get people riled up? Well, Jesus said this in Matthew 5:9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. And James 3, verse 18 says, peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. So we're to leave a trail of peace behind us, not angry people. Of course, we should not let money influence us to move away from doing the right things. In a few weeks, when we get back to our Hebrews series, we'll actually be looking at this passage from Hebrews 13, verse 5, that tells us to keep our lives free from the love of money. And Exodus 23 says, do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the innocent. I don't have to give you Bible verses about how God calls us to be focused on the needs of others rather than our own needs. You know full well that God would be against putting others down in order to advance our selfish agenda. And of course, if we want our political leaders to live moral lives, then we ought to be sure we are doing that ourselves. So it begins with us. Instead of being angry and cruel, instead of lying and spinning the truth, instead of saying inflammatory things and being influenced unduly by money, instead of living in selfish and immoral ways, we Christ followers are to be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. We're to be kind and loving to others. We're to act and speak in ways that cause people to feel peace rather than anger. We're to be focused on other people's needs over our own, and we're to do our best to follow the moral code that God has given to us in the Bible. We need to develop these characteristics in our own lives. That's the first thing that we ought to do if we're thinking about fixing the way politics in America is practiced. And then next, I think that we should try to vote for people running for political office who display those types of characteristics, if you can find them. You know, when we vote, issues are very important. Of course they are. But character is important in leadership too. Now, I don't know about for you, but typically it seems impossible almost for me to find someone running for high political office who both displays these types of characteristics we've just mentioned here and also lines up the way we want them to line up on the issues. I have found voting to be a very difficult thing, and that problem will likely continue. So we're all just going to have to do our, make the best decision you can, given the options presented to us. But I do believe we need to hold to the conviction that issues and character are both important when we're selecting our political leaders, and we need to try to vote for people who are hitting in both of those areas. Maybe one of you should run for political office. See if you can do it in the way God would have you do it. You want to try that? I would vote for you. Yes. Let's begin training him. All right. All right. So we may not be able to do much to affect the American political system, but we can change the way we behave, and we can try to vote for people who display these characteristics, and then we can also do our best to teach people in our community, young and old, to live in these godly ways. Maybe some of them will go into politics and carry those values with them. All we can do is what we can do. I think those are the things we can do. Since we're on the topic of inflammatory statements, I want to make one more comment here before we move away from politics. So much has been made this last week of the fact that the young man who killed Molly Tibbetts was an illegal immigrant from Mexico. We talked about immigration recently, and I said, I think immigration policy is a very important debate to be having in our country. Frankly, I don't know that I'm against the building of a wall. I don't know about the expense and the logistics for that, but it seems to me that a wall would actually allow us to be able to enforce whatever laws we do decide to have on immigration policy. And as I said a few weeks back, I hope that the immigration laws we do come up with in our country do a good job of balancing out the goal of needing to protect our citizens and the goal of showing some compassion for those seeking to come here in order to escape terrible situations in their homeland. Anyhow, I do think that immigration policy is an important subject. What I am against, though, and what I would suggest all Christ followers should be against, are any comments made that might lump all people of a certain race or status into one category. My friends, not all illegal immigrants into our country are murderers or thieves. I am certain that many, and probably most, of those people are of no threat to us whatsoever. And they've simply come here out of desperation and fear for their lives and their previous home country. Yeah, if they're here illegally, then the government needs to figure out what to do about that. But Christ followers, we are to lead with love. So let's be very careful not to make statements that would inflame and perhaps cause others to think that all people of a certain race or category behave in some way morally. That's not a right thing or a fair thing to do. We can take steps to protect ourselves from people who are legitimate threats to our safety, but let's be careful in what we say about people and how we say it. Got on the internet yesterday, and I researched the people who have committed probably the most publicized acts of murder, civilian on civilian and not domestic disputes, in the United States in the past 2 years, and I've got their pictures for you today. Here's the man who killed 5 people in the shooting at the Capital Gazette's newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. A school shooting took the lives of 2 students and wounded 14 at Marshall County High School in western Kentucky, and that crime was committed by this young man. 8 people were killed and about a dozen injured when this person deliberately drove down a bike path in New York City. This 19-year-old opened fire at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida in February of this year, killing 17 students and staff members. Also in this past year, this 17-year-old student killed 10 people at his school in Santa Fe, Texas. This next man was the primary person involved in a shooting spree at a 24-hour arts and music festival in Trenton, New Jersey that wounded 22. Here is Stephen Paddock, who killed so many at that concert in Las Vegas last year. And finally, here is the man who killed 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando about 2 years ago. Molly Tibbetts' aunt wrote a reminder to us all on her Facebook page a few days ago. She wrote that evil comes in every color. And I'd say these pictures back up her statement. So, every people group was created by God, and every person is invited into his kingdom through a saving relationship through Jesus. The Apostle Peter said in Acts 10, "I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but accepts from every nation the one who fears him and who does what is right." Let us not be involved in overstatement and in stereotyping. Let us not be involved in inflammatory talk that might lead people to anger and to hatred of certain races or classes of people. Let's keep level heads and pursue peace. All right. It's time to move away from politics now. I wish we were moving to a better subject, but I'd like to now talk about what we might be able to do about the problem of leaders within our churches being involved in these terrible moral failings. Well, once again, on this topic, I'd say it starts with us. You don't have to be a pastor to give Christianity a bad name because of your sin. Each Christ follower is called to fashion a growing and a consistent walk with God, and each Christ follower is being watched by people who are outside of our faith to see if they are walking consistently or not. All of us have the ability to further God's kingdom and God's goals in this world or to hinder and harm them through our sins. No Christian is a sinless person, of course. We've all failed in the past. We'll continue to fail at times in the future. And frankly, that's one of the greatest things about this message we're trying to relay to the world, right? Jesus came to save sinners, you and me. I can relate to Bill Hybels. Maybe you can, too, to some extent. I've been in the situation before of telling everybody that I was a Christian believer because I was. And 90% of the time, I was living that out consistently. But then I also had this little secret 10% of my life where I was sinning. And I either felt unable or unwilling to rid myself of that aspect in my life. I wonder if that has ever described you or something close to that. Even saved people cannot live perfectly righteous lives. We're all sinners. However, that does not mean we should relax about sin. Sin remains deadly serious. That sin in my life brought about destruction in my life and in the lives of others. The Bible calls us to run from it. Here's 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Therefore, since we have these promises, dear friends, the promises of forgiveness and love from God, let us then purify ourselves from everything that contaminates body and spirit, perfecting holiness out of reverence for God. We are to move from sin, which leads to death and destruction, and into right living, which leads to life. So the Bible calls us to sin, calls us to battle against sin, in part by bringing it into the light through confession. Doesn't necessarily mean that you need to lay out your sins for everybody out there, but I think it does mean that we should do this with at least a trusted few who will help you in the battle. Paul writes in Ephesians 5 that we are to live as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And we're to find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, he writes, but rather expose them. It's shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible, and everything that is illuminated becomes a light. And similar thought in Proverbs 28:13. He who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. So we're to battle against sin, and part of that effort is through the confession and the bringing to light of our sin. You know, secrets aren't going to stay secret anyway. The truth is going to come out eventually. So let's get on top of this stuff and fight it. Don't let sin ensnare you and bring harm to you and to your loved ones and to your church and to the church, as we've been talking about here. Flee from it. Very serious stuff we're talking about. We know from our Bible reading that the Bible teaches that it is even more important for the leaders of the church to be doing these things, to be above reproach. If any Christ follower has the ability to cause harm to the effectiveness of God's message in the world due to sins, then how much greater is the potential harm in the failure of a leader? And we've seen that playing out here in the Bill Hybels situation. So another thing we need to do in response to this problem of moral failing in the church, after getting ourselves right, is to put good safeguards in place in our own church. That's something we can do. I want to tell you about a few of the safeguards we have in place at Calvary in respect to these things, and we'll start with the pastor. I do have an accountability person who I have tasked with asking me the hard questions about my Christian walk. I also have a policy that I try hard to be consistent with, of not being alone with a woman other than my family members. So most of you ladies, if you have met with me in the past, have either had me ask if I can meet you at the pantry or if you can come to church on one of the days when Joni is in the building too. I watch that principle especially close when it comes to my interactions with the youth group kids, and they'll tell you that. For example, last person off the bus whenever I'm taking the kids home on Wednesday night has to be a boy, even if that means we got to go out of our way a little bit. The kids know this. They don't really understand it, but they know it. I've asked the other youth leaders to also be conscious of these things and their roles. And everyone who works with young people or children in our church has to go through a background check. Anyone in leadership of any sort here at Calvary should have by now received a copy of a document titled The Covenant for the Leaders of Calvary Baptist Church, which makes very clear what our lifestyle expectations of leaders are here. And the document also encourages the person, if they find themselves struggling with sin during their time of leadership here, to bring it to the attention of either myself or the church chairman or the head deacon. And again, we would hope to assist that person in their battle against sin. And we would try to take appropriate steps with them. And again, we always need to be remembering, no human being is immune to moral failure. Love and grace need to be applied to all, even to those who have failed, like Bill Hybels now, as he's going to go through this process of needing to let the truth be known. Love and grace needs to be applied to all, but sin hurts people, and it's serious, and we need to take it very seriously in our lives and in our church. Well, we may not be able to do much to eradicate these types of moral failures from happening within the church as a whole, but we can work towards living increasingly in the way God would have us in our own lives, and we can work to have good safety measures in place in our own church. Things we can do. Last topic to discuss, and it's the one we opened with, one of the oldest and worst sins in the book, and that's murder. I am at an absolute loss to explain why anyone would ever commit this sin. From everything I've read, Molly Tibbetts was kind to everyone, always seeking to help people when they had a problem. What possibly could have motivated this young man to hit and kill her? It's probably beyond understanding. But I do think it's the definition of sickness. I think it's the definition of evil. Boy, and yet it's happening all the time in America. Those eight situations we just looked at pictures of. All events that have happened in our country within the last 2 years. It's astounding. It makes my stomach turn. So what can we do about this problem? I'll tell you what we can do. We can get out into our community here and get to know people and work to lead them to Jesus Christ. Yeah, many are going to reject our invitations to come to church and to talk about God, but some will be receptive. And maybe, just maybe, we might alter someone's path. A path that was going downhill and heading towards perhaps a story like this young man Christian who murdered Molly. Perhaps a potential storyline like that could be altered by our efforts and by the Spirit of God working through us to bring healing and life to that person. Pastor Doug Sathern, who filled in for me last Sunday, told the story of how Jesus relayed a very important command to his followers after he had been resurrected, and that command was to go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And Pastor Doug also pointed out that those early followers of Jesus, when many of them moved out of Israel because of persecution there and settled in lots of these other countries, they didn't just stop at living in those new towns they came to. They got to know people, and they told people about Jesus, and the church spread. We cannot stop at just living here, or even just knowing people. We need to talk about Jesus, and to do our best to bring his life-giving message to as many people as who will accept it. You know, I guess this story of Molly Tibbetts' death just makes me realize all over again how incredibly important this task is that Jesus has given to us, this command to make disciples. And of course, Molly's story stuck out to me especially because she's from a town just like ours. We've always said that some of these things we read about in the news can happen here, and I'd say this story proves it. 6-hour drive from here, Midwestern town of the same size and makeup. Molly's one of ours. This could have been one of our young people. We must do our part to be the light in the darkness in Madison, to be a group of people who go into our community encouraging and offering paths to spiritual health with God, and to mental health, and to social health, and physical health. We ought to be a beacon of light and health. Jesus encouraged those who followed him in this manner from Matthew 5, 14, 16. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. We have the most important job in the world to do, Calvary Baptist. And that is to let God's light shine through us and invade the darkness that many people in this, our community, are stuck in. We're nearing the end of our Calvary remodel project. There still are a few things left to do there that I'll talk to you about in the near future. But we are getting close to being done with that. And the idea has been all along that once some of those things we wanted to fix up about our own church have been taken care of through this remodel, we would then dive even more fully into reaching our community for Christ. And so I want you to know this is coming. In this next year, you're going to start hearing from us more and more about getting very intentional about doing all we can to bring the people who live in this community to Jesus. Okay, one last reason to mention here as to why this task that Jesus has given to us is so important. The story of Molly Tibbetts demonstrates something else that we all already know, that none of us know when our last day on earth will be. Certainly Molly wasn't thinking that was going to be her last day. Every person in our community, whether young or old, may be approaching their last day. We need to be sure that before that day arrives for them, those people have had every opportunity to enter into a saving relationship with Jesus Christ. Because that changes everything. I'm going to show you now a video clip, 2 minutes, that's gone viral since it got posted on YouTube recently. And this is a clip of Molly Tibbetts speaking to a group of young people about a cross-country meet she had been a part of. It likely will be hard for you to hear some of it, so I'll repeat the things I want to make sure you heard when we're done watching it. So here is Molly from 2 years ago.
So we went to our conference cross-country meet. And I hadn't run at the last two meets because I just felt like just really like down and I really could not breathe and I just felt really weak. And so our coach decided that it was probably best if I didn't run at them because they were really hilly and he just didn't think it was the best thing to do for me. So he didn't have me run those two meets. So the day came for conference cross country and I just remember waking up and being so nervous because I hadn't run in a meet for over a week and conference is obviously an important meet. And just thinking, you know, how am I going to do this? How am I going to make it through this meet if, you know, I haven't run, if I can't even breathe? There's all these people who are doing so well over here. And I'm nowhere close to where I was here before. And I had no idea what to do. I was so scared. So for the first time in my life, I've prayed before, but I had never gotten down on my knees and just prayed to God. So I did. I got down and I prayed. And I asked God to give me the strength to make it through it, to tell me what to do, to help me out with whatever happened and to know what his plan was. So we got to the meet and I was feeling like I did at the last two meets, but my coach told me he really wanted me to run. He knew I was strong enough to do it. And so I decided to do it. And the whole time I kept thinking about God and he was on my mind the whole time and I was breathing like I had been the whole season. One girl, Saya Erisman, she ran by me. She's like, "Are you okay?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm fine." So I kept running, and I ended up getting my best time of the season so far. And when I got done, on five, my little cross-country buddy, she came up to me, and she's like, "Did you make it through the meet?" She's like, "I saw you cheering for me." She's like, "I didn't think you could to finish." I'm like, "Yeah, I actually finished really well. I got my best time." She's like, "Oh my goodness, I was praying for you the whole time. I was just hoping that you were okay." And in that moment, I kind of knew that that was God's way of showing me that the power of prayer was really something, and it was something that used in my life and everyone's life, and that I had doubted him, and he needed to prove to me that he really was all that there was in my life. That was it's not a huge, big story, but it really meant a lot to me to see God working in my life, even with something as small as just like a spoon.
Hard to hear, I know. So let me relay a little bit of that to you again. So Molly was telling a story from the previous year in her life when her cross-country season had not been going well. I think she was having some health problems, hard to breathe while she was running. And so she had a big race coming up, and she was very nervous. So she says even though she had prayed in the past, for the first time in her life, she got down on her knees and asked God to give her the strength to get through that race. The race day came. And Molly got going in it and was still having trouble breathing. But she said that she was thinking about God the whole time that she ran, and she ended up finishing with her best time of the season. And then at the end of the race, a friend of hers who had known about her breathing struggles came up and asked her how it had gone and was excited to hear that it had gone well. And then that friend told her that she had been praying for her the whole way. And Molly said, "In that moment, I knew that this was God's way of showing me that the power of prayer was really something. I had doubted him, and he needed to prove to me that he really was what everyone said he was." And she finished there by saying, "It's not a huge big story, but it really meant a lot to me to see God working in my life, even with something as small as that sporting event." I know very little about Molly. I can't tell you if she was living a lifestyle fully sold out for God or not, but certainly we have seen some evidence here that this young woman had that saving relationship with Jesus that we all need. We have some evidence here that she knew God, and so like I said, that changes everything. Doesn't make me less sick about what has happened to her, but it can allow me to say that even in this terrible event, there is hope. Hope that Molly has now been brought to heaven. Murder and death are nightmarish things, but folks, Jesus Christ has triumphed over death. The eternity thing changes the perspective of this whole thing. Just as when Jesus died and evil thought that it had won. Same thing applies here. The enemy found a broken person in this Christian, Rivera, that he could use to cause pain, and that pain was experienced. But the enemy once again has not won here. Jesus has won. Molly's won. So, about Molly, we can cry out with the Apostle Paul, "Where, O death, is your victory?" "Where, O death, is your sting?" But we know that there are still some in our community, young people and old people, who do not have that relationship that God offers to them. It's up to us. We've been commanded by Jesus to make disciples here. To be sure that if a person is murdered in our community here in the future, we will also be able to say in that circumstance, "Death, where is your victory?" So this is something that we can do about the sin of murder that's far too prevalent in our country these days, and it's something we can do about the death that is coming to everyone in our community at some point. We can get out into our town, get to know people, and work to lead them to Jesus. I think these things ought to motivate us to evaluate our priorities in life. You know, we do need to have fun. You know that I think we ought to live life to the full, and we need to laugh, and we need to do all of that stuff. But man, aren't some of the things that we pay attention to in life trivial compared to this great task we've been given by Jesus Christ, this task of helping people come to salvation through him? We need to get after it. And if the news about Molly makes you as sick as it makes me, let's take this and turn it into energy to do God's work in our community. Calvary, this world is a messed up place. Raise your hand if you're sick of it. I'm sick of what I have to read in the news headlines each day, but there is an answer to these things, and his name is Jesus. Jesus is the answer to all this stuff that ails us. There's darkness all around us, Calvary, but we can redouble our efforts to advance the light. And I'll close with this verse, John 1, verse 5. "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." May God be with us and lead us and enable us.